From The Conversation, this is Politics with Michelle Grattan, a podcast where we hear from politicians and experts on the issues of the day.
Victoria is the state that Labor is looking to make significant gains at this election. The Liberals had a wipeout at the state election last year, and federal factors, especially the dumping of Malcolm Turnbull, played a role in that. Feelings may have diminished somewhat since then, but the Liberals remain deeply worried about their prospects in what is considered the most progressive state in the nation. To talk to us about Victoria and also about the complexities of the Senate, we have today Tim Colbatch from Inside Story. Tim Colbatch, let's start with the mood of Victoria. How different do you think it is from the time of the state election?
I don't think the mood has changed significantly. Labor's still very popular at state level as far as I can see. What is different is that we've got a different set of issues and a different set of actors at the federal election than at the state election, which of course was a wipeout for the Liberal Party, and Labor won 2/3 of the seats almost.
Nevertheless, the state result did have some federal factors in it, particularly the dumping of Malcolm Turnbull. Do you think that's faded?
I think it has, because the new issues have emerged. The Liberals have run a surprisingly good campaign so far. Things have gone in their favour, and Labor hasn't been as articulate as one might have expected in saying why it wants to do what it wants to do. So it's really to do with that separate issues that have come up, and the resentment about Turnbull is still there, and I think particularly in the blue ribbon Liberal seats like Higgins and Kooyong, but it's diminished.
Do you think politically Victoria is very different from other states? We know obviously it's very different from Queensland, but is it very different from New South Wales? Is it the most progressive state in the Commonwealth? Is it the Massachusetts of Australia?
Yeah, I guess it is really. I mean, it certainly has had for now 40 years almost a definite Liberal character to it, which has been different from New South Wales and from the other states, although South Australia and Tasmania, I think, are a bit more like Victoria. But, I mean, the Liberals have won only 6 elections there in the last 40 years, so that's a pretty strong example of how Labor dominates the Victorian political scene. And the Liberals have not adjusted. And you mentioned Massachusetts. I mean, in Massachusetts, the Republicans have turned Liberal to accommodate, whereas we haven't seen that in Victoria.
We have seen today the dumping of a Liberal candidate for anti-Muslim sentiments. Does this show that the parties in general, the major parties, are just not vetting their candidates enough?
Well, I guess it has to be in this particular case. Yes, you'd think that they would go through everybody's social media accounts and find out what they'd said, and that would have sent red light alert to whoever was vetting.
Well, especially in a state like Victoria, actually.
Yeah, and in a seat like Isaacs. Well, he's not going to win Isaacs. I mean, that was never a winnable seat for them, so I guess perhaps people in that situation didn't get vetted as carefully as those who might actually end up in Parliament. But, it doesn't look good.
Now, let's turn to the particular seats in Victoria. Which ones realistically are in play for Labor wins?
Well, I divide them into two categories. There are two seats that have become Labor seats notionally, the redistribution. That's Dunkley and Corangamite. And then there's the third seat, Chisholm, where Julia Banks quit, of course, the party, and the Liberals are in bad water there. So those three seats are seen as being pretty certain to go to Labor, although there's some dispute about Corangamite. Then there's a second set of seats, which are really open. That includes Casey, the seat of Tony Smith, the Speaker, Latrobe, which is a classic marginal seat held by Jason Wood, Deakin, a slightly harder ask for Labor, but that is a seat where Turnbull's dumping may resonate because Michael Sukkar, the Liberal member, was one of the key actors in that dumping. Flinders, where Greg Hunt, the Health Minister, is in serious trouble, and even possibly Higgins, where the old seat of Kelly O'Dwyer and before her Peter Costello, which has never been won by Labor, but which Labor would have won on state election voting.
Well, let's take Flinders as a particularly interesting case because Julia Banks is standing there. She's moved from her former seat of Chisholm. As you say, she's a Liberal defector. How do you think that's going?
Well, I haven't been there, so I can't report from the front, but the fact that Julia Banks announced this week that she is directing preferences to Labor is obviously going to help Labor and make it harder for Greg Hunt to hold on. It made it look pretty clear that she's not really standing to win the seat. She's standing to as payback for Greg Hunt's role, again, in dumping Turnbull. And you have to suspect that he may be one of the people she's saying was bullying Liberal MPs to vote for Dutton in the leadership challenge.
And of course, Greg Hunt was not just a strong Dutton supporter, but had hoped to be Dutton's deputy.
Indeed, yes. Yeah.
What about Higgins? Just unpack Higgins a bit for us.
Higgins, again, I say it was voted Labor on state voting. A Reachtel poll in November found Labor ahead, and I'm sure that must have played some part in Kelly O'Dwyer's decision to quit. It's a very unlikely win for Labor. I mean, it's very posh territory, some of the two racks in Higgins, but spread now down to the area where Bill Shorten grew up in Murrumbeena, and it could be foreseeably a Labor win in a big landslide year. Whether this will be that landslide year, I doubt.
Now, you talk about posh territory, but some of the so-called posh territory is where social progressives, people who are concerned about climate change, maybe that's not a social issue, but a progressive issue, are located. Is this a factor in that electorate?
Yeah, very much so, I think. One of those things that's come up, people report, has come up when they've been door knocking and talking to people. The failure of the government to tackle climate change is a real drawback for the Liberals when they try and confront an electorate like this, because it's full of an educated, wealthy people who understand that we have to do something and don't mind the cost of doing it. Same is true, of course, next door in Kooyong, where Josh Frydenberg is up against the lawyer Julian Burnside running for the Greens.
And Oliver Yates, too.
And Oliver Yates, who's the former head of the Clean Energy Authority. Yep. And it's also an issue in Flinders. So all those seats where you get a series of normally rusted-on Liberals who are well off, follow issues and understand that you can't really ignore climate change. You have to tackle it. The failure of the government to do so is a real drawback for it.
Politically, in Kooyong, I would have thought that Josh Frydenberg is totally safe. The thing is that it has tied him down, that the intensity of the contest in that seat, hasn't it?
Yeah. Well, no one foresaw the Liberals losing Hawthorne at the state election, and Hawthorne is entirely in Kooyong. So there is form in that area. And they almost lost Brighton too, which is where I grew up, another blue ribbon Liberal seat. It does strike me that they've done a lot to try and show the flag in Victoria. Morrison's been down there frequently. They've announced a million infrastructure projects and grants to local councils and car parks.
And $250 million for the removal of a level crossing in that area between Kooyong and Higgins, right on the border, I think.
Yes, that's right.
A lot of money.
It's a lot of money, yes. They're trying to do it a very expensive way by putting the rail line underground, which is why it's going to cost so much.
And, of course, level crossings normally are a state affair.
Exactly. The state will decide what is done about that level crossing, not the federal government.
So let's now turn to the Senate, Tim, because you're one of the few people that even attempt to get your mind around this complexity, which is certainly beyond most of us. Now, half the Senate is up for election. It's extremely difficult to make predictions, but what's your overall impression of how the new Senate might differ from the old one?
I think it will have fewer crossbenchers, and this will be the first election for a long time that we've seen fewer crossbenchers coming in. It's going to be particularly hard for the minor parties of the right to get candidates elected, because they tend not to preference each other. Their voters, that is. And don't forget, it's the voters who will determine preferences this time, not the parties themselves. The parties can say on their how-to-vote card, this is how we want you to vote, but most voters do not vote that way. We know from numerous studies done of it that, in fact, most voters make up their own minds and only a minority follow the card. And I think it's going to be very difficult for the minor parties that are only going to get 5% of the vote, probably in most cases. They won't get up to 14.3%.
Now, is one reason for this that the government brought in some changes to really cut down on preference whispering, and this is the first half-Senate election where those have operated. They operated last time, but the fact it was a double dissolution sort of negated the effect.
Yeah, last time Normally, the quota at a half-Senate election is 14.3% to get a senator elected. And last time, being a double dissolution, that was dropped to 7.7%. And that made it very much easier for people like, for example, Darren Hinch in Victoria, Jackie Lambie in Tasmania, One Nation in a number of states, David Lionhelm, to get elected. And that's not going to be there this time. And the gap between, if you're getting 5% of the vote, the gap to 7.7 is not that hard a jump. The gap to 14.3% is a very hard jump indeed. Now, I think the Greens can do it because the Greens are going to poll, in most cases, around 8 or 10%, maybe more. And they tend to get more preferences from left-wing, minor left-wing parties than the right-wing parties get from other minor right-wing parties. So I think the Greens are probably going to be okay, but what I would see happening overall is that the coalition is likely to win a number of seats that are now held by the crossbenchers.
Just focusing on the Greens for a moment, they have half a dozen senators going out.
Correct.
And so that's quite a large portion of their Senate party. Do you think they will get them all back?
I think they will get at least five of them back. Yeah, I think if you look at, I mean, Victoria is a strong Green state, Tasmania, Western Australia, those three states all have a strong history of electing Greens at almost every election. New South Wales, Labor is not doing that well, so Labor is the Greens' main competition, so I think the Greens will get through there. Queensland, they did very well at the state election, and I think the Adani issue might work for the Greens against Labor in Queensland. So I think those five will probably, the Greens will probably hold on to. The one who's in trouble, most trouble, is Sarah Hanson-Young in South Australia. It's never been a good state for the Greens, and she's limped home every time she stood pretty well. And I think that'll probably be the case again. Well, it'll be the case again that she will limp home if she gets home. But South Australia is going to be a very hard state to call because we've got the Centre Alliance.
Which is the old Nick Xenophon team.
Yes, the old Nick Xenophon team, which is no longer as strong as it was in 2016 when it got more than 20% of the vote. But it's still getting around 7% of the vote, as far as we can tell, in South Australia, and that makes it a competitive force for us in the Senate election. And
big fall, though.
Big fall.
It shows how these personality-oriented parties come and go, doesn't it?
It was one of the most bizarre stories, I think, and bizarre exits of any Australian politician.
Now, talking about another bizarre thing on the minor party front, how do you think Clive Palmer's party will go, and how do you think One Nation will go?
Well, the polls suggest it's really only getting 4 or 5%, and that's after months of saturation advertising on television. Clive does not have a good record to defend on a lot of fronts, and if Labor, now that he's thrown in his lot completely with the Liberal Party, there's nothing to stop Labor running anti-Palmer advertisements highlighting the fact that he has not paid his workers, he has not paid the tax office, how come he's got the money for all this advertising? And I don't think he is a particularly saleable political leader.
But you could also ask, how come he's even there at all, that we're even talking about him as a possibly potent minor force?
Well, he's got a lot of money and he's spending it. If Rupert Murdoch stood for Parliament and spent a lot of his money, he would probably be up there too. But I think my view is that Clive might be a force in Queensland, where I'm sure he's spending more money than anywhere else.
And standing for the Senate
and
himself.
Standing for the Senate himself. But it's a fascinating contest because the way it's going to work in Queensland, you'll always get, in every state, the first four senators elected will be two Liberals and two Labor, or two Coalition, two Labor. And then the last two seats are the ones that are up for grabs. And they will go roughly one to the left, one to the right. And the one to the right in Queensland will be fought out between Clive Palmer, Fraser Anning, Malcolm Roberts, the climate change denier who is Pauline Hanson's number two, and a rather wacky Liberal called Gerard Rennick, who has conspiracy theories that the Russians had nothing to do with poisoning the Skripals in Salisbury and that the Bureau of Meteorology is making up climate figures to suit its global warming agenda. So, and only one of those people will be elected, but one of them will be elected. So it'll be very interesting to see who comes through.
And would you be taking any bets on who it'll be?
Look, I think Clive probably has an edge because he's got more money.
Now, just to finish up, there has been speculation that if Labor wins the election, it will have a lot of trouble getting its policies through the Senate, so casting doubt on the viability of some of these promises. What do you think about that?
Well, it's a very valid argument, yeah, because Labor has some pretty ambitious tax agenda, and in fact it's by far the biggest, most important policies that have been put up at this election are Labor's tax plans. And the Centre Alliance is going to be, as far as I can see, is likely to end up holding the balance of power in the new Senate, and it's said it's not in favour of abolishing negative gearing or capital gains tax, various other, certainly franking credits, all those sort of things are going to be a hard ask for it. But it has shown some room to negotiate, and you would know better than anybody, Michelle, you've seen so many, this happen so many times, that minor parties have said, we're not going to vote for this, and then they sit down with the government and the government says, well, we'd like to give you this. And eventually they end up voting for what they said they wouldn't vote for. So I don't take that as a final outcome, but it does suggest that there's going to be considerable problems and considerable uncertainty over whether Labor can get its tax agenda through. And then if it doesn't get its tax agenda through, there'll be considerable uncertainty over what it can afford to spend on all that, those social policy fronts, health and education, so on, transport, that it has promised to spend.
Your talk about uncertainty prompts me to ask another final question, and that is, what chance do you think that we could get a hung parliament?
It's possible. I'm a little... My gut feeling has always been that the election was lost long ago. People tend to vote not just on what happens in the campaign. It's far more important what happens in over the 3 years of government. And they haven't... It's poll after poll has made it clear they haven't liked what they've seen. So it's a huge ask for the Liberals to come back after losing about 160 consecutive opinion polls to come back and finally win it at the last minute.
In the poll that counts.
Yeah, in the poll that counts. But then... It could be. I mean, there certainly seem to be... There's pretty strong evidence that they're making progress. I follow the poll bludger's poll track, and he's come down from something like 52.5% for Labor to about 51.5% now. If that momentum to the Liberals continues over the final weeks, well, a hung parliament is certainly a possibility.
Tim Colbatch, thank you very much for enlightening us on Victoria and the Senate. And that's all from our election podcast for today. We'll be back with another one soon. Thank you to my producer, Eliza Burlage. Goodbye for now.
And if you're itching for more election analysis, check out The Conversation's other podcast, Trust Me, I'm an Expert. You can find it on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you're listening to Politics with Michelle Grattan right now. Our theme music is by Lee Rosevere. You can find more podcasts from The Conversation on our website at theconversation.com.